ask you to please unmute when you have questions, comments, and so on. And I'm starting the recording as well. And welcome to week two of a planned three on the Kabbalists of Tzfat. As I fully expected, we are not going to go quite in terms of the biographies I had anticipated. In other words, we had said the first week would be Rabbi Yosef Karo, the second week would be Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, and the third week would be Moshe Alshich. But I knew when I set that up that Rabbi Karo, especially with the introduction to Kabbalah overall, was going to need more than 1 week. Rabbi Yitzchak Luria, certainly so. So what's going to end up happening is this week we are going to complete our look at Rabbi Karo and start on Rabbi Luria. Next week we'll complete our look at Rabbi Luria and we'll have a little bit about Rabbi Moshe Alshich. I wish I had the freedom to just add a week to the series, but it's not going to happen. So we started last week with our introduction to Kabbalah. We talked a little bit about where Kabbalah comes from, what its goals are, and we moved from there into the growth of Kabbalah in Tzfat, a time of flight from persecution, a time of upheaval of communities. And I actually wanted to go back to something that I had said then, because in doing some of my preparation for this week, I noticed that there were a couple of things that were worth noting that I had not really mentioned regarding why Jews came to Tzfat and why mystics came to Tzfat in particular. Two things that are worth noting. Last week we had said that mystics come to Tzfat in the 16th century because, first of all, there's already a nucleus there. And we brought the quote from Professor Rabalowski to that effect. We noted that there were holy sites in the area, in particular the grave of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai in Meiron. And we noted as well that being off the beaten track, you recall we looked at the map and saw just how off the beaten track Tzfat is. So that was good for people who believed in meditating out in the wilderness, going off and being alone, the process that we call Hitbodidut. But I wanted to add three other notes in terms of why Kabbalists came to Tzfat at this point. So, first of all, we already noted that in the 16th century, really the end of the 15th, you're getting people who move into Tzfat from the Iberian, well, into the Ottoman Empire, from the Iberian Peninsula, people who were kicked out of Spain in 1492, out of Portugal in 1496. So, interestingly, that included a lot of Jews who were in the textile industry. I don't know, you know, what the connection is from there to the shmata business, and you know, a few centuries later. But Jews were in the shmata business even back then, so they set up shop in the Ottoman Empire, and in particular, they go up to the Galil, up to the north in Israel, and they establish a base. And that's really, really important. Not that Kabbalists were necessarily garment workers, but they were supported by garment workers. Meaning that in order for a community of Kabbalists to survive, you need an economic base. So the fact that you have a thriving industry is very, very important. There's a note in the chat that somebody wrote they were not allowed to own land, but that's Christian Europe. We are now in the Ottoman Empire, and their rules were different. So that's something that it's another reason why they would move to Tzfat. You actually had an economic base. But I also wanted to know two factors which were important after the rush to Tzfat was already underway. Number one, the Ottoman Empire conquered the area that we know as Israel in 1517. Until then, it was under the Mamluks out of Egypt. The Ottomans conquer it in 1517, and then they start reinforcing and building fortresses. So in the year 1549, under Suleiman the Magnificent, they fortified the city of Tzfat with a wall, and they stationed soldiers there. And that made the city more secure. So that's another reason for Jews to go there. And then the last, and really the one I wanted to get to make sure to add, the last reason why mystics would want to be in Tzfat has to do with a prediction that the Messiah was going to come in the year 1575, and that he was going to show up first in the Galil, in northern Israel. If you take a look at your sheet, you'll see what I'm talking about. Top source is a verse from Daniel, and I specifically brought you the Hebrew along with the English for reasons that we'll get into in a moment. These are the last two verses of the book of Daniel. Some of you actually learned Daniel with me years ago. The first half of the book of Daniel is basically stories of the Persian Empire. So the first four chapters, stories involving King Nebuchadnezzar, the fifth one involving King Belshazzar, and then the sixth chapter is about Darius, who was a king of another empire, Darius of Media, it appears. And then after that, the second half of the book of Daniel involves a lot of predictions of a messianic time, all sorts of visions, very, very difficult stuff to understand. The commentator Don Isaac Abarbanel traces all of the events of the second half of the book of Daniel to events in the Christian and Muslim empires up to his day at the end of the 15th century. But here are the last two verses of this book. Fortunate is the one who will wait and reach the days, 1,335. And you, speaking to Daniel, go to the end and you will rest and you will rise for your lot at the end of days. So this is very clearly a reference to messianic beliefs. This is also a reference to beliefs about Tchiyat HaMeitim, the ultimate resurrection of the dead, which we actually discussed in a class back in November of last year. I think it was November of last year. COVID has really thrown off my sense of time. But I remember we were at Beth Emmet. That I remember. But there is a prediction based in the Zohar regarding this text here that you see, that it's actually a reference to the year 1575. Why 1575? The reason for 1575 being the prediction is because if you were to take the gematria of those Hebrew letters in the last two verses of the book, the last two verses, what you see there, you will end up with the number 5,335, which, in terms of the general civil calendar, is the year 1575. Gematria, for those who are not familiar, is a system that assigns a numerical value to each letter in the alphabet. So when working from the Hebrew alphabet, if you want to sit down, I brought you the Hebrew letters there. If you want to sit down and do the math, you can. I used a calculator to just quickly do it, and the numbers worked out, but you know, feel free to do it by hand. The bottom line is that out of that comes a prediction that the year 1575 will be the year of the Messiah. I can go into more of it because there's more to this calculation, but it doesn't matter for our purposes right now. But take a look at the second source on your sheet from the Zohar, in which it says, at that time, the king Mashiach will awaken to leave the Garden of Eden from that place which is called the bird's nest, and he will awaken in the land of the Galilee. So if you're a mystic in the 16th century, you have to be in the Galilee. I mean, the Messiah is going to come. He's going to be up north there. How in the world would I miss that? So that becomes another reason for mystics to migrate to Tzfat. Clear? Okay. That's just adding to what we said last week. But now let's go forward. We talked about Rabbi Caro and his family's migration from the Iberian Peninsula first, into the Ottoman Empire. At some point he's in Egypt, and ultimately he ends up in Tzfat. And we explained last week that he has a tremendous pedigree as an authority in Jewish law. He is recognized as a leading rabbinical authority. When he arrives there, he makes a big impression that way, although he's known that way before that. And we talked about his major works of Jewish law, how he wrote a legal history as his Beit Yosef. It was a commentary to a code of Jewish law called the Tur, in which he wants to show you the different points of view, the different perspectives on particular legal issues throughout all the practical issues of Jewish law. Then we moved from that into talking about his Shulchan Aruch, his code of Jewish law, in which he tries to summarize and give you the basic practical results of his Beit Yosef discussions, and that's meant to be a reference work to be studied every 30 days. And then finally, at the end, we talked about his Kesef Mishnah, his commentary to Maimonides, and how Maimonides got into so much trouble for not including his sources in his code of law, and how this attempt by Rabbi Caro is to provide essentially a bibliography that would help people to be able to learn the texts of Maimonides and understand it better and apply it in Jewish law. So he's a tremendous authority from a Jewish law perspective. He also wrote Responsa. That's a separate thing. And I wanted to just note one other element, which is going to lead us towards his mysticism, but one other element of his Jewish law pedigree. And this is the ordination controversy of the year 1538. So this requires a bit of an explanation. Rabbinical ordination, what do we call ordination in Hebrew? What's the term for it? Smicha, right? Smicha, correct. That's rabbinical ordination. Literally, smicha, I rely upon someone. That's one possible etymology for the word. You're declaring that you rely on the person. Or alternatively, because the original form of ordination, which we find in the Torah when Moshe gives it to Joshua, involves putting his hands on him, leaning on him. And that's called lismoch yadayim, to lean his hands on him. In any case.
Does it also come from to trust?
Right, so that was my first explanation, to rely on. You're correct, Ricky.
Trust
him. Yeah. So the original form of smicha would actually be the rabbinical court gathering with the person who is being ordained and declaring that that person is credible, giving that person the authority. As I think I mentioned once before, might have been in this series, might have been elsewhere, you didn't just ordain people because they achieved a certain level of expertise. Ordination was done to fill a particular position. So in other words, there was a rabbinical court in a particular town, or there was a town that had a halachic authority who then passed away. We need to fill that position. We're going to ordain somebody who's able to fill that position. You didn't have a million rabbis running around without portfolios. You only got ordained if there was a spot to fill. That's a very important difference between original ordination and what happens today, which is essentially a certificate of achievement. But the Romans recognized that having ordained rabbis was critical for the survival of the Jews. Those Jews who kept rebelling against the Romans long after the Second Temple was destroyed, they felt, we need to put a stop to Jewish ideology. We need to put a stop to the transmission of their teachings. And so what we're going to do is we're going to get rid of ordination. And the way they did it, as the Talmud records it, was relatively straightforward. They said, in the event that you convene one of these courts and ordain somebody, we're going to execute the rabbis on the court who did the ordaining. We're going to execute the rabbi who was ordained. And we're going to execute the Jewish population of the nearest town. Problem solved. No one's able to ordain. And the consequences of this in Judaism are tremendous. Because rabbis post that date, however great their expertise, do not have the authority to handle certain issues in Jewish law. Certain issues require full ordination. So I'll give you a couple of examples of that. For a rabbinical court to be able to fine somebody for misbehavior requires ordination. The ability to innovate, to create rabbinic decrees, requires ordination. The ability potentially to lift a rabbinic decree will require ordination. There was discussion last year before Passover. People wanted to know, could we institute a leap year in order to push off Passover by a month, thinking that by then COVID wouldn't be such a big thing and maybe people would be able to get together, which of course, in retrospect, Yeah, your month would have done nothing. Nonetheless, there were people at the time who said maybe we could do that, get the rabbis together and create a leap month for that year. Without ordination, you're not even starting. It's not even a concept. So there's more to say about that. It's a more complicated issue, but just highlighting the role that ordination plays in the national life of the Jews in terms of how Jewish law works. So at that point, and you're talking roughly 5th century Common Era, maybe 4th century, when that gets cut off, from that day forward, ordination simply means you developed expertise such that your teacher says, okay, now you're ready to answer people's questions. Somebody wants to know, am I allowed to do that on Shabbat or not? You're a reference work. That's essentially what ordination becomes. Fast forward to the 12th century, and an interesting statement that Maimonides makes in his Code of Law, his Mishneh Torah. And if you take a look at source number, what did I put that there for? I wonder why I put that. I don't know. Source number 4 is what I want. I'm not sure why I included source number 3. It's an important text, but it's not for what we're doing right now. I think source number 3 was when I wanted to explain more about what Rabbi Caro did in explaining Maimonides' sources. But take a look at source number 4. This, again, is from Rambam, from Maimonides. He says, it appears to me that if all of the sages in Israel would agree to appoint judges and ordain them, they would be ordained. Maimonides offers you a theory about how we could restart ordination. All you need to do is get all the sages to agree to appoint judges and ordain them. Well, that would be easy, right? We can totally get everybody together and they'll just agree and they'll pick somebody and say, we want to give that person ordination. Like, what could be simpler? So, that no one acts on that idea for centuries. Until Tzfat in the 16th century. There was an attempt led by a rabbi by the name of Rabbi Yaakov Beirav. Don't worry about the name, it's not going to be on the final. But Rabbi Yaakov Beirav, also known as the Re Beirav, that was the way people knew him, creates a gathering in Tzfat of rabbis with the goal being to restart ordination. Why? Two reasons. Number one, there were thousands upon thousands of Jews who had been forced to adopt Christianity or die under the Inquisition, under the threat of expulsion and so on, and now wanted to come back. They wanted to be accepted again in the Jewish community. And the problem was that they wanted to have a rabbinical court decree what their penalty should be as a penance, so to speak, to be able to come back. And it has to do with the question of how a Jew who has gone off and accepted another religion can be re-accepted. A rabbinical court could play a key role in that process. So they said, if we can restart ordination, we can accept all of these people back in the fold without question. That's goal number one. Goal number two is to usher in a messianic time, to usher in the time of Mashiach. And that's something I want to come back to a little bit later. So they create a gathering in Tzfat, and they declare, we want to ordain Rabbi Levi ibn Chabib, who was the chief rabbi of Jerusalem. In other words, we're not ordaining one of our own. This isn't about stature. We're going to take the chief rabbi of Jerusalem and give him ordination. But the chief rabbi of Jerusalem rejected the entire enterprise, and he said, this is nonsense. Maimonides' theory is a theory about how it can be done. But you can't really do that. Well, that doesn't stop Rabbi Yaakov Beirav. He goes on to anoint a handful of others, including Rabbi Yosef Caro. Now, Rabbi Caro himself never actually wrote anything about approving this process. He doesn't go out and say, now I am ordained. In fact, in certain places in his writing, he says, today we do not have ordained courts. But it mattered to him, and we're going to see a little bit later just how it mattered to him. But I bring that story here just to show you how respected he was. He is one of the handful of sages who get this new ordination in an attempt to restart smicha. Are we clear so far? I'm doing a lot of monologuing.
Can you just repeat the year of this?
1538. Okay. Because now I want to transition to talk about his mysticism. Because even though Rabbi Caro is an authority in Jewish law of the highest order, he is, as we said last week, heavily mystical. And this is the chief mystical idea that I want to express for Rabbi Caro. It will be expressed further and developed further when we talk about Rabbi Yitzchak Luria. It's about how I look at Jewish law and Jewish practice. From Rabbi Caro's perspective, a mitzvah is not part of a dry checklist of ritual activities. Every mitzvah has mystical significance. Some of you were there when we had our class on the Kabbalah of Mitzvot. Some of you were there for that. I gave you a link for it in last week's source sheet. And what we said back then, and I'm just going to put the source sheet in the chat again because I saw a couple of people sign in. What we said back then, when we talked about the Kabbalah of Mitzvot, is that the Zohar presents insights that inform mitzvah practices so that mitzvot are seen as having a mystical impact on the universe. So that, if you take a look on your sheet at source number 5, I brought you a couple of passages which we discussed back in that series. Take a look at source number 5. The Zohar, Parshat Vayakhel. The sanctity of Friday night is the sanctity of Shabbat of Breshit, the Shabbat of creation, which was sanctified from 32 paths and 3 levels of the sacred apples. We're not talking paths and apples right now. And for that sanctity, we must state the deeds of Breshit. In other words, when I recite Kiddush on Friday night, and I say that Shabbat is Zecher L'Maaseh Breshit, to remember the deeds of creation, not only am I personally remembering God created the world, but I am somehow mystically channeling sanctity from 32 paths and 3 levels by mentioning creation. My mitzvah activity has a mystical impact. Or in source number 6, the impact of studying Torah. When a person produces a holy declaration from his mouth, a declaration of Torah, when we speak Torah, a voice is produced from it, it ascends above and arouses the holy ones of the highest king, it is crowned and it causes great joy in realms above and below. My mitzvah, opening up a chumash and reading a verse, just that, reading something aloud from the source sheet, is having some kind of mystical impact. So the first step in understanding the mysticism of Rabbi Caro is that he is of the belief that our activities, the mitzvot we perform, have mystical significance. That's point number one. Point number two is that gaining insight into Torah, into God's message, is not only about using reason, it's also about revelation. It's not only about using reason, it's also about revelation, okay? Just like at Sinai, we received the Torah, right? We get Torah not just from the study of texts and the ideas we glean from there, but also we get revelation from God. So even though the Torah itself says, Lo bashamayim hi, that Torah is not up in the heavens, and that's interpreted by the sages to mean that we are responsible for Torah, that it doesn't, you know, a prophet can't come and redo Torah and change Torah. The Torah is here. Nonetheless, there's a concept that God will reveal Torah to a person who studies it. Even that a malach, an angel, can come and reveal Torah to somebody who studies it. It's not the same as prophecy. Prophecy is different. Prophecy is gone for 2,000 years before the time of Rabbi Caro. Prophecy is, hang on, Susan, a message being sent that you are now going to share with the world. That's not what this is. However, it's a process of revelation in which, when you study, it's not just about you and the words and you and your teacher and you and your study partner, but something being revealed to you from God. And that informs the way Rabbi Caro approaches his learning. There's an element of revelation, which we're going to come back to. Susan.
Regular population.
So what makes you think that this is new with him?
Well, maybe not new, but in such depth, he seems to, I don't know, I just thought, like, he was a Kabbalist, but what brought him to mysticism, I guess?
Right, and so it seems these are ideas that exist. He's not pioneering these ideas. We're going to talk more about this. I think, did I mention it already last week, or am I mentioning it this week? I forget. That we said that he has a Magid who speaks to him, this angelic embodiment of the Mishnah that talks to him.
Himself.
Right.
He talks like himself.
But he's not the only one. That others have this experience, as well. He's not unique in that regard. He's just supreme in the way he embodies both, which is remarkable. So his first point is that mitzvot, Jewish law, are also about mystical impact. Number two, study of Torah is not only about reason and logic, it's also about revelation. And number three, the concept of dvekut, the concept of dvekus, to use the Ashkenazi version of it, drawing close to God, cleaving to God. That's something that is heavily in mysticism, and it's also in rationalism, the idea of drawing close to God, and drawing close to God in your study. Take a look at source number 7, right? Moses Maimonides, rationalist extraordinaire, describing the mitzvah of loving God. What is the appropriate love for God? To love God greatly, excessively, powerfully, to the point that his soul is tied to love of God, he is perpetually lost in it like an ill person who is ill from love, whose mind is never free of that woman, and he is perpetually lost in it, whether sitting or rising or eating or drinking. Beyond this should be the love of God, as God instructed us, with all your heart, with all your soul. The supreme rationalist describes being lost in an overpowering love for God, wanting to be close to God. That is something that empowers and enables a more mystical approach. And it, as we'll see, feeds into his Kabbalah. So, let me now that we've tried to present a little bit of his background in Jewish law and a little bit of what helps him to bridge Jewish law to mysticism, let's talk about that mysticism. As we said, there's active mysticism in Tzfat before Rabbi Caro arrives. Rabbi Moshe Cordovero, who we're going to discuss much more about when we talked about Rabbi Luria, was born in Tzfat in the year 1522. He was the lead Kabbalist of the time until Rabbi Luria. Rabbi Shlomo Halevi Al-Kabetz was there. He was Rabbi Cordovero's brother-in-law. So there were others around who were mystics. The way we know Rabbi Caro was a mystic is the text that I quoted you in the beginning of last week, the Magid Meisharim text, in which he describes the embodiment of the Mishnah, the most basic form of the Jewish oral law, actually speaking to him. Now, I should note, you won't be surprised, there is some controversy about whether this Magid Meisharim text is actually his. Is it really his? Meaning, did somebody else write this and claim that it was Rabbi Caro's text? Well, you can't prove anything. We can't absolutely prove it. However, as Professor Wobolowski notes, contemporaries of Rabbi Caro describe him having a Magid, having this being that talked through him and to him. And that supports the validation of the manuscript as his. And also, and this is what I had said to Susan a couple of minutes ago, Magidism in general, or Magidism, the practice of having a Magid, was actually widespread at the time. Take a look on your source sheet, please. It's source number 8, where I brought you from Professor Robolowski. He says, this is that same book that I showed you last week, Joseph Caro, Lawyer and Mystic. The student of mysticism needs no special proof that Magidism and similar phenomena, mentor angels, guiding spirits, voices, etc., exist, and that in certain periods and in certain groups, their manifestations can be fairly frequent and typical, not to say epidemic. He wrote this book decades ago. I apologize for the word. And he goes on to say, the many testimonies and reports about Magidim and other similar phenomena should not be underestimated. In spite of modern attempts in diverse quarters to boost the purely spiritual side of mysticism, it becomes increasingly clear that the history of mysticism does not necessarily justify the fashionable tendencies among writers on mysticism. Did you follow that paragraph? It's a sharp paragraph. He says, there's a tendency today to sort of call everything Kabbalah. Right? There's a tendency today to say, anytime you talk about spirituality, anytime you talk about feeling, anytime you talk about redemptive acts, all of that is somehow mysticism. He says, you can't write out of mysticism and out of Kabbalah the idea of talking to angels. That's there also. And he says, as far as Caro's Magid goes, we have solid contemporary evidence, meaning we know from accounts from his time. For example, he says, Rabbi Chaim Vital, who we'll learn about a little bit later this morning, writes in his work, Shar HaGilgulim, that the Magid misled Rabbi Caro about certain ideas of reincarnation of his son's soul. Rabbi Caro had a son who had passed away, and he had said certain things about his son being a Gilgul, being reincarnated. And Rabbi Chaim Vital said, yeah, the Magid misled Rabbi Caro. The point is not to discuss reincarnation. The point is not to discuss the relationship between Rabbi Vital and Rabbi Caro, only to say that Rabbi Vital took it as a given that Rabbi Caro had a Magid. You follow? I'm worried I'm losing people because there aren't enough comments and questions. So I want to make sure that I'm not going too fast or making leaps here. Are we clear? Okay. I'm getting some nods yes. Etty, what do you think? You're muted.
It's a bit beyond me.
Yeah. And it's a bit beyond, I think, there are 70 Zoom windows open here. I think it's probably beyond all 70 of us. 70 is an important mystical number, you know. It's certainly beyond me. I don't understand it. I don't know what the experience is of having a Magid. But apparently, and this is what I'm trying to show, contemporaries were familiar with him having a Magid. And they, not only were they familiar with it, they discussed what the Magid taught him. So the idea that he had one did not seem beyond the pale at all for them. It seems to have been normal. There's a note in the chat about Ramchal, Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto, being persecuted. Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto was centuries later. He's in Italy in the 18th century. And he is persecuted because he said he heard from a Magid. So Rabbi Moshe Chaim Luzzatto's mysticism indeed got him into a lot of trouble. This was also in a world in which everybody remembered Shabtai Tzvi. Shabtai Tzvi, the false messiah, gave mysticism a really, really bad name. And there was a lot of fear surrounding Rabbi Luzzatto because of that. So I don't remember of specifically an account of a Magid, but it wouldn't shock me. Also a question in the chat, is there any indication that other societies had similar mystics in Magidim? Mystics for sure. Magidim would not surprise me. But I don't know anything specifically. So what does the Magid want of Rabbi Caro? Well, number one, he wants Rabbi Caro to cling exclusively to God and to Torah. If you take a look at source number 9, you'll see in the next several sources, I've translated some sections and paragraphs from Magid Meisharim so that you can actually see what's in it. So this is from a section called Shevach HaRav, about the greatness of Rabbi Karo, it would appear. The Magid says to him the following, God is with you, etc. Only adhere to me. Me, I capitalized it because I think it's speaking for God, not just for itself. Adhere to me and to awe of me. And do not separate your thoughts from my Mishnah, even for a moment. I have made you a leader of my people, etc. Have I not instructed you not to separate your thoughts even for a moment from my awe and my Mishnah? Do not eat and drink in the manner of pleasure at all, for what benefit is there in your pleasure in this world? Your thoughts should only be that if the soul could survive in the body without any benefit, you would want this very much. Thus you will always adhere to Hashem and you will merit to have miracles performed via you. To become an ascetic, right? To not pursue pleasure, only to pursue your needs to the extent that they allow you to continue to exist, and your focus is on God. Your focus is on your studies. That's it. And the vision is that this will lead to his spiritual growth, Rabbi Karo's spiritual growth, but not just about him personally, but to the overall redemption of the Jewish people. This takes us back to the ordination controversy. The second goal of ordination was to usher in the time of the Messiah. Meaning, we have a prediction in Isaiah chapter 1, in which God says that in the future, V'ashiva shoftayach kvarishona, I will restore your judges as they once were. And then, Zion, Zion, will be called Ir HaTzedek, Kiryat Ne'emana, the city of righteousness, the faithful city. In other words, bring back the judges, and then you will have a messianic time. You need righteousness, you need justice, and you need leaders. And so it is suggested, and I brought you Professor Obolowski in source number 10, suggesting this, but I'm not going to read it aloud, because it's basically what I just told you. The goal of restoring ordination is not only about allowing back in those who had been forced to live as Christians, but it's also about ushering in the time of Mashiach, the time of the Messiah. You follow? So Rabbi Karo is not just being instructed to purify himself and dedicate himself for his own benefit, but it's for the benefit of the world as a whole. And the benefit for the world as a whole will come not only via his mysticism, but also via his law. Take a look at source number 11, please. From that Magid Meshurim text on the Torah portion of Acharei Mot, the Magid says to Rabbi Karo, be strong and courageous in your Torah, as you do with Torah, Mishnah, Gemara, Rashi, Tosfot, rulings, and mysticism. Mishnah and Gemara, the texts that make up the Talmud. Rashi and Tosfot, critical commentaries to the Talmud. Rulings in Jewish law and mysticism. Join them with each other. By bridging the two, you can usher in a new time, a time of Mashiach. That's the goal. What you need to do, Rabbi Karo, is to elevate your thoughts, to purify your body, to become a chariot for the Shekhinah, for God's presence, and avoid sin at all costs. And here, I want to show you source number 12. Source number 12 is a message of rebuke to Rabbi Karo from the Magid. He describes a particular event, something that happened to him. I ate only a little. He's describing what happened one night. I ate only a little bit, and so I did in drinking. I drank a little bit, and I studied Mishnah at the start of the night, and I slept until the light of day. And I woke, and the sun was shining over the land, and I was greatly pained, saying, how did I not rise while it was still night, so that the speech would come to me as usual? What speech is he talking about? So that the speech would come to me as usual?
The
Magid. The Magid, exactly. He says, I can't believe that I slept I can't believe I slept, and I slept through sunrise. Now, as a result of that, I am not going to have the chance to hear from the Magid. Still, I began to review Mishnah. I read 5 chapters. And while I was reading Mishnah, a voice, my beloved, knocked within my mouth, and that's a reference to Kol Dodi Dofek from Song of Songs, from Shir HaShirim. My beloved is the Magid, making music on its own, and it spoke. And this is what it told Rabbi Caro. God is with you wherever you go. All that you have done and will do, God makes you succeed. Only adhere to me, to my awe, and my Torah, and my Mishnah always. Not as you did this night, you slept. For even though you have sanctified yourself with your food and drink, meaning you don't eat a lot, you don't drink a lot, still you have slept the sleep of the lazy. But, he says, I'm just going to mute everybody by default. But, he says, in the merit of the 6 orders of the Mishnah that you know by heart, and in the merit of those self-denials and afflictions you performed in the preceding days, and even now you adhere to them, they have agreed in the heavenly academy that I may return to speak with you as at first. So the Magid says, all right, you slept in this morning? That's bad. But you're redeemable. You can still be redeemed. You're getting a sense of what this involves? What it is that this mysticism is about? It's about a complete and total dedication to God, a complete and total dedication to study and to purification. I'll show you one other thing. Yes, Ethi.
I have a problem with all of this. It sounds very much like the Christian nuns, that they're cloistering themselves and denying this and denying that. We're supposed to enjoy life. That's, I think, part of the Judaism, is it not?
So you're asking a very, very good question. And it's a big topic. It's not a small one. There are opposing trends which can both be based within Judaism. One trend is to say, we embrace the physical world, God gave it to us, and God means for us to use it, and we have mitzvot that govern how we use it, and we dedicate it to God, and so we recite Kiddush, for example, right? We sanctify the mundane by using it for God. And that's one approach. And then there's another approach that says that's all well and good at one level, but there's a higher level. And at the higher level, you actually stay away from the mundane. You view the mundane as potentially a distraction, something that's keeping you from becoming greater. So that's fine for everybody else. They can, deal with the mundane, but there's a higher goal involved. Someone had a note in the chat. Oh, there it is. Rosa put a note in the chat asking about the Zohar being a recluse in a cave. The Talmud tells the story of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai, who is credited with writing the Zohar, having to go into hiding from the Romans. He lives in a cave with his son for 12 years. After 12 years, they hear that the decree against them from the Romans is over. The people who issued it had died. They come out of the cave, and wherever they look, wherever they look, explodes into flames. They see a man plowing, and they can't understand why he would be spending his time plowing instead of spending his time on God. And God says, go back in the cave. I didn't let you out in order to destroy my world. So you could read that story and say, see that? They were wrong. On the other hand, wherever they looked exploded into flames. That means that the Talmud is trying to tell me that they had an extreme power. They actually had unique gifts. You can look at it in multiple ways. There's a lot. I mean, there are a lot of sources you could bring regarding this. The sages in the Midrash talk about Moses separating from his wife so that he could talk to God at all times. But his sister Miriam criticizes him for doing so. And then God defends him, saying Moshe is different, right? There are all sorts of sources you can bring on this. The bottom line, Eti, is that while what you are expressing is, I think, powerful and important, yeah, the idea that we use this world, it's not the only way to look at things in Judaism. The truth is more complicated.
Can I?
Yeah.
You're talking about Bar Yochai coming out of the cave.
Yep.
And saying, why is this man plowing?
Yeah.
Well, how is he going to eat?
So that's actually a really, really good question. The Talmud brings a debate. When you say Shema, right, in the second paragraph of the Shema, V'hayayim Shamoa, we are told that when we do what we're supposed to do, God says, when you do what you're supposed to do, V'natati esa v'sadcha levhemtecha v'achalta v'savata, I'll put grass in the field for your animals, you'll eat and you will be full. And it also mentions, V'asavta diganecha, you will bring in your harvest. So that leads one sage in this classic debate, Rabbi Yishmael, to say, see that? You're supposed to go work your field.
Right.
Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, same speaker, the one from the cave, says no. You devote yourself to God, and the harvest will be taken care of. Don't worry about it.
By other people.
Yeah. But that's the thing. These are two legitimate schools of thought within Judaism. You can't say one wins and one loses. Janine notes in the chat that the early German pietists of the 12th and 13th century were very much in line with what we see here from Rabbi Caro, that kind of an approach, in which you're seeing him become an ascetic. Mind you, he's not preaching this for everybody else, saying everybody else has to do it. The code of Jewish law does not does not take that tack. The code of Jewish law does not say eating is prohibited. But understand that this is part of his philosophy, and it's a strong philosophy. I want to show you source number 13. The Maggid promises Rabbi Caro something startling. And because you devoted your spirit to returning the crown of ordination to its ancient standing, remember I told you, him seeing ordination in a mystical light? Because you devoted your spirit to returning the crown of ordination to its ancient standing, you will merit to be ordained by all the sages of Israel and the sages of the diaspora. Through you, I will restore ordination to its ancient status. I will give you the merit of completing your composition, meaning your writing. And after that, you will be burned to sanctify my name. You will dissipate like pure wool, etc., and you will merit the resurrection of the dead. That's actually being promised to him as a good thing. To die al kiddush Hashem, to sanctify God's name. And that's also something that's seen in among the pietists of an earlier period, actually during the Crusades. He wants final purification. He wants to be a burnt offering for God. That's the idea. So one more question you have to ask when you read all this. The question you have to then go into is, so does this affect his Jewish law? Does this affect his halakha? When he gives you prescriptions, are they mystical or are they coming from a rational tradition? We've already seen the Maggid approve of Rabbi Caro connecting mysticism and law. In fact, sometimes the Maggid actually teaches him law. Take a look, please, at source number 14. If I say to you the following words in Aramaic, tell me if you're familiar with them. V'yatzmach purkanei v'karev mishichei. What are those words from?
From the Kaddish, Rabbanan.
From Kaddish in Sfard. Right? Ashkenazim don't say it. But in Sfard, that's right. V'yatzmach purkanei v'karev mishichei. It's a wish that God's redemption, his Messiah, should come soon. So take a look at source number 14, where the Maggid says, now I have come to reveal to you the secret of sanctity. You should know that which my chosen one Solomon said, that one should not respond amen after vikarev mishichei, is not true. one must respond amen five times. He's giving him a technical statement. You're supposed to say amen at this point in the Kaddish. So that suggests that there is a bridging of mysticism and law. Not only that, there are times when he uses the Zohar in Shulchan Aruch, in the code of Jewish law. However, generally speaking, his rule is, I was going to bring you sources on it, but felt like I was already source heavy. But the rule that he brings essentially is this. If there is a debate among classical sources, rational sources, and there's no resolution, Rabbi Caro is willing to use the Zohar in order to resolve the dispute. However, he's not going to use the Zohar to override the existing conclusion if the rationalists have already come to a conclusion. He's not going to overthrow the rational tradition based on mysticism. You follow? I realize there's a lot here, but I'm trying to express it somewhat clearly. Myrna. So no, there were contemporaries of his who even recorded it. And some after as well, yes. Yeah, as startling as it is. Heather and then Susan.
It sounds to me that some of it's very obsessive behavior, almost like if you don't follow this, you could be feeling very guilty and sad, you're very torn. It's, you know, to me, I don't know, how do you feel about that, being told this, and then either you do it, or if you don't, then you're not leading such a righteous life.
Right. So I'm glad you commented, because I saw your note in the chat. I wasn't quite sure what you meant. Now I understand. So I would say two things. Several years ago, I gave some classes about obsessive compulsive disorder, and I talked with some psychologists and psychiatrists about it. And one of the messages that emerged that I heard from them very powerfully is that a behavior is not considered to be obsessive, or I should say abnormal, really is the right word, if that's standard in one's community. In other words, if culturally this is what people do, then it's not considered to be abnormal, because it's not, because it is normal. It's not considered even maladaptive. I mean, there's more to be said about that, and you know, I can refer people to the classes I taught on it, or better, to an actual psychologist or psychiatrist if they want to know more about, you know, about how OCD works. But because this is actually part of the norm in his community, and in predecessors of his, it actually would not be considered, you know, an unhealthy thing being asked of him in order for him to gain approval. It's a lot more demanding than what we're used to hearing about. But it wouldn't have been out of the norm in that world, and certainly for someone who aspires to be the greatest of the great, which he does. Heather,
so
following up? Yeah.
That seems like a very good answer to that, which I didn't think about. But how do we, as we try to go through our history and understand where we fall, understand what to take from it?
Mm. So that's also a strong question. To me, the answer is that what we are to do is look at what he prescribed for the world as opposed to what he prescribed for himself. You know, this was a standard to which he held himself, but in his Shulchan Aruch, in his code of Jewish law, he's not telling you everybody has to refrain from eating and drinking and sleeping. He does set a standard, make no mistake, but he doesn't. But he doesn't say this is now a standard that the whole world has to follow. Susan, then Nurit.
I'm confused about his dual personality. Like, I mean, he's both. He is the Mikey, yet he talks as if the Mikey is almost like what we used to think schizophrenia was. He had two personalities, and one was the Mikey and one was him. Because he seems to follow the Mikey, but the Mikey is telling him what to think.
So I am 100% sure that a secular psychologist looking at this would offer a diagnosis along the lines of where you're going. That this is him speaking to himself. It's an expression of something perhaps that he's not ready to confront consciously, and therefore it's expressing itself in this way. You could definitely see, I could definitely see a secular psychologist looking at it that way. But Rabbi Caro and his whole mystical school are not looking at it that way. They're seeing this as the embodiment of the Mishnah coming to him and speaking to him. This
so
is not...
Like a supernatural being,
yeah,
sort of enters him and pours out the words through his mouth.
Yes. I understand the difficulty in understanding that, but that's what he's saying. Etty asks in the chat, you could say that about the prophets. The difference between prophets and Rabbi Caro is that a prophet, by definition, is given a message to tell everybody else. By definition. So much so that the vast majority of Jewish sages said that Daniel was not a prophet, even though he heard from malachim, from angels, because he wasn't given a message to tell others. So there's a different type of an experience going on here. This is closer to Daniel than it is to the prophets. I'm just going to take Nurit's question, but there's a note in the chat that's very important that I want to also address. So Nurit, and then the note from Malka in the chat. Right. So I would say this. It is definitely something that is anchored in earlier Torah and solidly in sources like V'hapta et Hashem Elokecha Talav Hashem, like the quote I brought you from Maimonides where he talks about the intensity of loving God. There's no doubt that you could easily anchor what Rabbi Caro is talking about in classic traditional Torah. Even though it's not what's expressed usually in halakha for the masses, in what generally is people's Jewish practice. If the rabbi goes into somebody's house and sees that he has a couple of bottles of whiskey around, he's not going to say, well, now you're violating Judaism, unless it's Pesach. But otherwise, he's not going to say, well, how can you have something that's a source of pleasure in your home? But Rabbi Caro, if you walked into his house, I'm pretty sure you're not seeing whiskey there. It is a different approach, but it's not necessarily something for everyone. Malka had a note in the chat asking regarding interpreting the Zohar. Did any rabbis have disagreements about interpreting it, or alternate opinions, or was it considered like the Bible of mysticism, which you can't argue with? So basically, what we're going to see when we talk about Rabbi Luria, which clearly is going to be next week, but what we'll see then is that as new approaches to mysticism came along, they read themselves into the Zohar. So that before Rabbi Luria, there are what are called the Spanish schools of Kabbalah, of mysticism, that trace themselves to the Zohar, see themselves in the Zohar. And along comes Rabbi Luria, and he expresses his own ideas, which in some ways are very different from the ideas expressed by those Spanish schools. But he also shows you. You can see that in the Zohar as well. So you're not so much arguing with it as you are saying, actually, the Zohar means what I said. You don't see, as far as I am familiar, outright disagreement with the Zohar. The Zohar says this, but my mystical tradition says that. That I am not familiar with seeing at all. I gave you on the sheet, I gave you review questions, which I hope will be useful. We had, today we saw the last four of the review questions. I'm just going to run through them quickly. Two major purposes of the attempt to restart ordination were to readmit the Jews who have been forced to accept Christianity and to usher in a messianic time with the restoration of the judges, like in the prediction in Isaiah chapter 1. Three ways the study of Jewish law can be mystical. Mitzvot have mystical significance, not only rational significance, like we talked about with Kiddush, like we talked about with learning Torah. Torah study is also revelation. It's not only about intellect and reason. And cleaving to God, drawing closer to God. These are all expressions of mysticism. What did the Maggid want of Rabbi Caro? To stick to God and to Torah exclusively, and to develop spiritually in a way that would lead to a messianic redemption for all. And finally, does Rabbi Caro incorporate mysticism into his legal writing? And the answer is yes, but not as the supreme authority. Jewish law remains primary. So what we have to do next time is go through Rabbi Luria. I will try to get to the Alshich, also Rabbi Moshe Alshich, but probably we're going to spend an hour on Rabbi Luria, if I had to guess, because you can't cheat him of his time. But the groundwork that we laid this week will actually help us a lot when we try to understand what Rabbi Luria was doing. So I'm going to stay on, as always, for a few minutes for people who have questions and comments. But thank you very much, and I look forward to continuing next week. Be well.
Thank you, Rabbi.
Thank you. Questions and comments from anyone?
Rabbi?
Yeah. Yes, Myrna.
Okay.
Yeah.
What's that all about? Because it's thin stuff. This, this is so far removed, they don't know what they're doing. Far not
concerned. So, Rabbi Caro was not selling Kabbalah water.
Right.
The reality is that the modern wave of the last 20, 30 years, and maybe a little older even, the truth of the matter is, as I get older, I have to update that number. But that wave was and is in part a response to people feeling a need for something more spiritual, and there are teachings of Kabbalah that lend themselves to that. Even just the basic idea that we're going to come back to next week in Rabbi Luria's teaching, that my actions have an impact beyond the rational and beyond what I can see, that they can actually redeem the world, is something that is very powerful, right? Go back to Viktor Frankl and Man's Search for Meaning. People are looking for meaning, and this helps them find it. So they're not learning the hard texts. They're not staying away from food the way that Rabbi Caro is, they're latching on to a particular element within Kabbalah and substituting that for Kabbalah as a whole. But they're not the first to do that. Among the early Hasidim, you also find that they adopted elements of Kabbalah, but not all of it. You know, when you think of the Hasidim and their approach of God is for the masses, you know? That approach is, can be, to a certain extent, very much one of Kabbalah, and then to a certain extent, antithetical. It also depends on which branch of Kabbalah you're in. Not all of Kabbalah is this very stern version of Rabbi Caro. Someone asked me, by the way, if I want to stop the recording. I thought we would record the questions, but if anyone wants to hold a question until I turn off the recording, I can do that as well. But I think that that to answer your question, they've latched on to elements of Kabbalah. and decided to call it The Hole, but they're missing a lot of the grounding, and they're missing a lot of the bigger picture in order for it to be legitimately Kabbalah. And worse, there are people who are looking to, to make a living off of it, which is what, that was never what it was about.
Rabbi.
Yes, Sandy.
When you were, the question was brought up, is, doesn't this sound like a compulsive obsessive? And you said, it actually was sanctified by people in the community. When you get communities acting in such a way, they could be all acting in and reinforcing each other in a group compulsive obsessive activity. And it becomes to the extent that if you do this or you don't do this, you will be punished.
So it's true that communities can engage in unhealthy behavior, but that's not going to fit under the banner of obsessive compulsive. In other words, the problem with communities doing that is that it's bad for people in the community. That doesn't make it a psychological disorder. That doesn't make it a psychological disorder. It may just be something that's unproductive and unhelpful. When you have a cult, for example, if a cult engages in certain activities, that doesn't mean that they're obsessive compulsive. That may mean that it's a cult and problematic in that regard. Okay. But the thing is here, there's nothing maladaptive in the sense of destructive to life, in the sense of harming other people, in the sense of destructive to property. There's nothing here that manifests in a way that I would recognize as dysfunctional.
Yeah.
It happens not to be the way that many people today live their lives. Etty, I'll take your question.
Why then? Kabbalah, like, forbidden?
Oh boy, that is a very good question. So, in a nutshell, this is something we're going to see some of next week as well. The teachings of Kabbalah can lead you in directions that are antithetical to basic Jewish teaching. So, next week, one of the key ideas we're going to see from Rabbi Luria is the concept of tzimtzum, which is going to suggest that the way that God created the universe is by withdrawing from a particular space in order to make room for the universe to occupy it, which suggests that God isn't infinite, which Judaism has a real problem with. There are teachings in Kabbalah that make it sound like God is male or female when neither term makes any sense when you're talking about God. There are terms in Kabbalah that make it sound like there are multiple. Pope, I forget the name of the Pope now, I think it was Julius III, actually sanctioned the printing of the Zohar in the 16th century because he felt it supported Christianity. So there's a lot of stuff there that you can get way off base in. And so, therefore, different writers at times in Jewish history said you have to have a degree of stability in your life before you approach that. Maimonides said you have to have a really good understanding of basic Torah first. You have to fill your stomach with meat and wine, was his expression, before you're going to go into that. Others said you have to be married, you have to be 40, all sorts of things. Madness, I'm not so clear on why it would lead to madness. Heresy, yes. Right. And that was the big fear with the early Hasidim, that they would go the same route. Malka points out that Shabtai Tzvi's movement builds on Kabbalistic messianism. And that's for sure true. Right. Right. Him and then Jacob Frank, a couple of generations later. All right, there's much more to say, but I'm going to have to go. But thank you very much, and I look forward to continuing next week, God willing.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. Happy Hanukkah. And, yes, Chagu Im Sameach, Happy Hanukkah.